This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. The Cape Breton Council MP talks about a number of local investments in the riding. We'll hear more about the Hawks Dreamfield project welcoming some of the best local entertainers in the business, and a look back on coal mining history with a new virtual tour at the Miners Museum. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Mary Pat Mombercat says it's been a hard run for the Cape Breton Miners Museum because of COVID-19. Attendance numbers went way down, but they have a new virtual attraction there, and she says it's going to be quite a hit for the people who've been there before or for the first time.
The Miners Museum opened in 1967. It actually got it started in 1964. They started digging a mine to help pay for the museum. And then Nina Cohen got a board together and a bunch of fundraisers together to raise the funds, you know, over and above what they were selling the coal for to build the Miners Museum. And it also was a 1967 centennial project, so that helped fund a good portion of the museum. So the museum's been around for over 50 years, and it's huge in the community. I mean, it really does tell the story of Cape Breton, because Cape Breton was built by a bunch of immigrants coming from all around the world so they could work in the coal mines. Now, they were sold a bill of goods back in the day. They were told, you know, they would come, get a good job, they'd have houses to live in, and that, you know, they'd prosper. That wasn't really what happened when they got here, but nevertheless, Cape Breton was founded, you know, like and populated by people from all around the world to build the coal mine. And we tell that story. And it's such a wonderful story, and it really does touch people, because, you know, that's where we all came. We all came to this country looking to build a better life. And our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, that's what they did, and we actually have that better life.
Mary Pat, you mentioned the bill of goods not living up to its promise for the people traveling here from all over the world to work in the mines. What was the reality for them?
Well, they were housed, but if they somehow were injured or they died, their families were thrown out of the housing and just, you know, there was a man, of several probably, but I know one story specifically, where they picked his bed up out of the house because he was crippled and he couldn't move, moved it to the street and threw the family out into the road. So the housing was not unless you could absolutely work. And you paid rent on that housing. And how you paid the rent was you went underground and you mined your coal and it was docked from your pay. Just as these miners, the only place they had to shop for everything they needed, like their food, their fuel, their clothing, anything they needed, they had to go to the company store. And that also was docked from their pay. So in fact, some days these miners would come up at the end of the week and go for their pay and realize they had a negative number. They were not getting a nickel. And back in those days, people had huge families. So it's you know, their families were going hungry. People were going without shoes. It was a very, very, very rough life.
And there were probably so many people who were desperate to make wages to feed their families, and some of those very large families, that the company didn't have to put much stock into their community relations or its reputation in the way they handled their employees.
Well, as I said, they had huge families, so like their labor was cheap because, you know, that there wasn't a whole lot of jobs going around. So the coal was the most important thing. Productivity was the most important thing. Miner safety was not, because behind the one miner that was underground, he might have had four or five, six, maybe eight sons. So there was that going on. So they didn't really value the workers at all. In fact, you know, back in the 20s when there was the strikes going on, they hired basically thugs to get the miners back to work, and they just, you know, they shut off the power, they shut off the water to the miners' houses, and when the miners protested, they just shot indiscriminately into a crowd. What these people went through to give us a better life is it's beyond what we can understand in today's world.
And mining involved such incredibly hard, dangerous work and long hours, and there was always the possibility that someone's father or brother or uncle wouldn't be coming home after their shift. And a lot of us here have a family member or had a family member who had worked in the mines, and those stories are very real, and it's something that a lot of us can relate to.
Absolutely. You look in any of the mining communities around here, and every one of us has, you know, relatives that did this for a living, and they've got stories. They got stories that go back for generations. So it is, you know, like, you know, my grandfather was a miner. He died in a roof collapse. I mean, we just have to be so grateful for what they put themselves through so that we could have a better life. You know, they really, back in the days, the miners, because of what they went through, they started the first unions. Unions wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the miners. They were the people that started Medicare. So it's a lot of stuff that we have in this world that makes our life so much better. It began with the miners on Cape Breton Island.
So many of us are lucky today to have safety nets like sick pay or employment insurance. But back then, if you were hurt, you didn't go underground for mining. There was probably not going to be any food on the table. I know that sounds a little dramatic, but was that the reality?
Oh, it was devastating. I mean, people starved back in those days, and people went through winter without shoes. It was normal. Like, you know, like I remember hearing a story from his son about his father who lost his legs in the mines, and if there was no wheelchair, he couldn't afford a wheelchair, so he put himself in his son's little wagon with two oars. He sawed off oars, and that's how he got around. I mean, what the hardships that they had to endure, we can never imagine.
Do you think schools should be spending more time in the classroom on Cape Breton history?
I absolutely do. I think it's unconscionable that people in Sydney don't know there's such a thing as William Davis Day, and I think there's so many people who don't understand the importance of what we as Canadians take as for granted, like our Medicare and our unions. That whole movement came out of Cape Breton. I think that really is important, and it should be taught in the schools.
And of course, making a reference to William Davis there, Davis Day being an annual day of observance for us here in Cape Breton. And if I remember correctly, he was under 40. And he had 9 kids, and that event, a seminal moment in describing a lot about Cape Breton's history, doesn't it?
Davis Day is really important for Cape Breton's history because it is the day that we remember everybody, every miner who lost his life underground. Davis sort of symbolizes the miners who lost their lives because of their jobs. He lost his life because, as I was telling you earlier, when the power and the water was shut off to miners' homes, they protested, and the police, the mining company police, shot indiscriminately into the crowd, wounding 2 and killing William Davis. So that's why Davis is important. And this was at the time, it was in 1925, that the unions really started to form, and people started to think that we have to work together to make a better life for ourselves. And that happened on Cape Breton Island.
If we can turn to COVID-19 for a moment, it of course had a major impact on the museum, like many businesses and tourist attractions. How did you weather that storm? Attendance went down 95%.
Well, we weathered that storm because we had a couple, several good years before that. Now, good years to us doesn't mean a whole lot, but there was little surpluses at the end of the year. So we basically used up all of our surplus last year. So this year, we're just crossing our fingers and hoping that people walk through our doors and you know, that we can still pay our bills. So it's a scary time, but I mean, It's happening for everybody, and we will get through this, hopefully. And I think now that we've got the simulator, we've got something to attract the local audiences. And up to this point in time, local audiences haven't been really drawn to the museum as much as people from away. So I'm hoping that the simulator gets locals through the door so we can... we can be around next year when people from away can travel here.
Yes, and some very exciting news for the museum, a new virtual attraction. What can you tell us about that?
It's fabulous. I mean, we have been working on this for 4 years, and it's finally here. And I'm telling you, I had huge expectations for this, and it's surpassed every one of my expectations. It is amazing. I mean, even my mind guides at the museum, you know, that they've worked underground for 30 years and then they've come worked at the museum as a mind guide. They love it. So it is absolutely authentic. Now, it should be authentic because the mind guides and members of the community helped create it. They were the ones who came up with the story and they came up with the narrative and we proofed the script. So it is very much a Cape Breton story, and it's really quite amazing.
And without giving too many spoilers here, Mary Pat, but for the people who visit the virtual tour, they'll meet someone named Angus. So who is Angus?
Angus is a retired miner. So when you come in, first off, you go into the orientation room. So that's where you meet Angus. And Angus comes and tells you a little bit about the history of mining. And then his wife comes in and tells you a little bit about what it was like to be, you know, part of a miner's family. And then Angus sort of takes us off into the virtual mine tour. And we go into the virtual mine tour where we sit in a rake car. And Angus is our guide, and he takes us down through the coal mines of the ages. So it goes back to the 18th century and then goes to the turn of the 19th century, turn of the 20th century. And we go up to about 1980, I guess, is the last sort of reiteration of the mine. And it's really a fascinating trip to sort of view the mines through the ages.
This project has a lot of moving parts. A lot of people contributed to make it happen. Can you talk about how the project came together and give us a sense of the amount of work that went into it?
Yeah, the work came together. I don't know if you remember, but back in, 2013, I guess I was when I got hired there. Well, the museum, there was holes in the roof and there was holes in the bricks and the rain was coming in through the roof. It was just, the place was falling apart. And we were very lucky. We got funding from the community, from the province, and from the federal government, and they did, a wraparound. So we got the building secure. And when we were doing that, we thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice to sort of plan after we get this the secure building, what we could do inside the building? Because everybody kept talking about like the underground tour and how amazing it was and how much they loved doing that. But if you've got mobility issues, you can't do the underground tour. If you're claustrophobic, you can't do the underground tour. And you're really missing out on the full experience of the museum if you can't do the underground tour. So Well, while we were building the outside and making it secure, we started creating a strategic plan about how we could make, you know, that the experience of a coal mine accessible to people who could not go underground. And the virtual mine tour was a huge priority in making that happen. So that was back in 2017 was when we came up with the strategic plan. And then in 2018, we started building it. And it's taken us a bit, but we finally got it built, and it is absolutely amazing.
And can we talk about the restaurant for a second? Visitors can enjoy a nice meal there again, right?
Yes, the Miners restaurant, Miners Village restaurant, is opened, and it's working really, really well with us. And it's great. Like, you can come and do a whole day at the museum. You can come and do the virtual tour. You can do the underground tour. You can tour around. We've got 15 acres of beautiful seacoast. And then you can go and have a wonderful meal over at the Miners Village restaurant. It's a great way to spend some time.
And the hours of operation, please. When can people go there to visit?
Okay, so we're open Wednesday to Sunday. The hours are 10 to 6. If you want an underground tour, you be here between 11 to 4, because the last tour gets booked at 4.
Okay, so on the line is Mary Pat Mumbercutt, Executive Director of the Miners Museum, inviting you back to this tourism attraction after a tough run with COVID-19, and they've added another dimension to their facility, a new virtual tour. Mary Pat, thanks again. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Lisa McNeil-Campbell is on the line again with us this week to talk about the Hawks Dream Fuel Project in Dominion, and a special fundraiser is coming up on July 24th. It's called A Cape Breton Night by the Fire 2.
So the Hawks Dream Fuel Project came about almost 2 years ago now. It would be 2 years in September that we got together after my dad, Walter McNeil, had passed away. We just decided, the family and I decided that we wanted to do something to honor him and kind of help us keep busy and to help us with the grief and stuff. So we gathered some people in the community and we sat around and discussed and decided that we would take the Hawks Field and make it 100% accessible, all-inclusive. So we brought that to Darren Brookschweiger, our counselor, and he was all for it. We took it to the mayor, and it kind of... it flew from there, and it's become a very important project to the whole community that we're super proud of. And it's a big project. It's $2.3 million approximately. Right now we have about $1.2 that we've received, either between funding from the government and money that we've raised on our own and some corporate funding. So we've got about another $1.3 to go or so. And that's what we're working on now.
So this project, dedication to your dad, Lisa, Walter McNeil, and he was among many to put the area on the map for baseball in Dominion.
Dad played ball, and from the minute he could pick up a baseball, he played. His father played with him, and he was actually scouted by one of the American baseball leagues, but he ended up having to go work in the mines to keep the family going. So that was my grandfather, Sonny McNeil. But Dad coached and he played and he watched, and he was all about baseball. And the big thing is he said, you can't learn if you don't play. So he wanted to make sure that everybody had a chance to play. Whether you were the best or the worst on the team, it really didn't matter. The point was to have fun and enjoy it. And baseball has such a huge history in Dominion. The field was built in 1911. And the colliery leagues, there were different, of course, mining collieries, and they would have leagues, baseball leagues, and compete. And those games, people would actually pay to go to the leagues, and they would draft people from the States to come in and play. It was amazing. And there was a gentleman from Dominion. His name was Heck Andrews. And he actually hit the longest recorded home run at that time in 1938 from the Hawks field in Dominion. He hit with a wooden bat. He hit the ball 478 feet out into the ocean, and there happened to be some fishermen out there, and they fished the ball out. So, and we actually have the bat that he used and the ball. And his grandson, Bruce Carabin, is actually on our Hawks Dreamfield team. So he's helping to make this dream become a reality as well. So it's pretty awesome.
And if we can talk about a very important fundraiser coming up for you guys, Lisa, on the 24th. We talked about it last time, and you highlighted as a very important part of the overall project.
So we have a wonderful event coming up to support. It's our biggest fundraiser of the year, actually, and it's called A Cape Breton Night by the Fire, too. It's our second one. And the event will be in person and online, streamed online via NovaStream. We have limited seating available for the in-person. We're hoping that we're going to be able to even expand that once we see what the weather's going to be like. But right now, there is limited seating. So if anybody was interested in purchasing a ticket for the in-person event, they can give us a call at 902-849-0764, or they can go to our website online, and it's hawksdreamfield.ca. As far as the community is concerned, we were super excited. We've had great sponsorship, most especially our gold sponsors are the Coast Radio 89.7, and we're very excited to have you guys on board, so thank you for that. We've also got Sobeys as a gold sponsor, and Boston Pizza was kind enough to come in as a silver sponsor just this past week. We're very excited about that as well, and we have quite a few of our bronze sponsors. We're incredibly grateful.
And the entertainment there is going to be quite a stellar lineup, and a tip of the cap to a host here from the Coast, Donnie Campbell, but so many more too. And the audience is going to get a pretty good fix of local music after being cooped up a long time from COVID. Some of the best in the area, actually.
We have the best entertainment in Cape Breton. I'll have to say Donnie Campbell is incredible. I don't think there's anything he can't sing or can't play. So he and Jinx O'Neill will be there. Jinx is awesome as well. Mario Colosimo from Dominion is anybody that's ever been to Seaside Days will recognize Mario. He's awesome. Aaron Lewis and Kimberly Fraser are going to be there. LJ McLean was added to our list. Heather Carr. Let me see, the Turnbull Brothers from Glace Bay. Nipper McLeod from the Men of the Deeps. Oh, Debbie McMullen. Oh, my goodness, she's amazing. She's living in Dominion, but she plays all over the area, and she's excellent as well. And we also have a very exciting performance online from Daniel O'Donnell, and it is specifically for this event. Like, it's not just us taking a video off of YouTube. He actually sent us a video for this specific event. We're excited about that. There's a couple of little surprises that we've got coming, and we will be unveiling our 3D concept of the field with the completion. So we're really excited to show everybody about that, and we're going to do a dedication of a part of the field that night, so lots of excitement.
And it's important to mention, too, you've made it a point to explain several times, this is a multi-purpose facility. It's not just for baseball.
Absolutely not. It's not. And a lot of people think, oh, it's another baseball being done, and baseball fields are awesome, but this is more than just that. It's multi-sport, so along with baseball, there's going to be a walking track around the perimeter. There's going to be two bocce ball courts, and bocce is a Paralympic sport, so Special Olympics, their group will be able to practice or have tournaments there, which is awesome. We will also have an accessible splash pad available for children so that children in wheelchairs will be able to go in and get cooled off. Our canteen building will have two full-size accessible washrooms with adult-sized change tables in them. Both change tables will be adult-sized, which is amazing. The inside of the canteen will be accessible so that anyone in a wheelchair or with mobility issues can actually work or volunteer inside. And the pass-through window will have a part of it where it's lowered to the level of a wheelchair. So if somebody was in a wheelchair or a motorized chair outside, they can wheel right up to the window and place their order on their own. They won't need assistance with that. There will also be seats, fold-down seats on the walking track. I think about every 30 feet, the dugouts will have fold-down seats so that we make room for wheelchairs and motorized chairs. And two of the grandstands will be covered and accessible, but covered is a big piece of it because we want to make sure that people that are undergoing any kind of treatment or have skin cancer or anything like that, that they can come and sit and enjoy under the canopy without the sun on top of them, and they can enjoy watching a ball game or the kids play.
And if you remember, Lisa, after the last conversation we had on the radio, you sent an email afterwards, very quickly afterwards, and you forgot to mention something, another special guest who's going to be there, a mascot.
We do have a mascot. Thank you so much. I almost forgot again, and I don't know how I could forget Hecky the Hawk. So as I mentioned earlier, Heck Andrews was the gentleman that hit the longest home run in Canada. So we decided to name our mascot after him. So he is Hecky the Hawk, and he is a hawk. But Hecky was born with one wing shorter than the other, and he also wears glasses because he has vision difficulties with his vision. But he still really loves to get out and play ball with the kids. So and the other hawks, you know?
And why is that exactly? Why the shorter wing than the other?
Well, we wanted children with disabilities to equate to him, you know, like that they could look at him and say, hey, he's got a one wing shorter than the other, but he's still playing. Well, I can play too. You know, that it's okay to be a little bit different. That just makes you special. We've commissioned somebody from the States to make the costume for us, to build Hecky for us. So we will have that hopefully for our opening ceremonies of the field.
Okay, got it. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
I just wanted to say thank you to the community for all of their support. They've been so incredibly amazing. We're really excited. The field is going to, construction should begin in August. The tenders will be going out soon, and we can't wait for the people in the community to see what this is going to look like and to see all the benefits that it's going to be, that are going to be there for people all over Cape Breton. This is not just a project for Dominion. It's a project for all of the people, residents and visitors of Cape Breton. I think it's going to be absolutely incredible, and we're very excited.
And just one more thing, Lisa, for people who want to find out more about the Hawks Dreamfield project and for a Cape Breton Night by the Fire too.
Sure. If anybody wants any kind of information, or if they wanted to buy one of we have T-shirts for the event too, for the Cape Breton Night by the Fire event, or tickets for their seats, they can go to hawksdreamfield.ca/shop, and all the information will be there.
Okay.
We also have a Facebook page as well and Instagram, so they can look us up on any of those.
Great. Thanks so much again, Lisa, for your time, and good luck on the 24th, and keep us in the loop on the project.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Cape Breton Liberal MLAs Jaime Batista and Mike Helloway announced on Friday nearly $3 million in funding to help the airport in Sydney recover from COVID-19. That money will help the airport maintain operations and essential services. Helloway dialed into the Coast as well to talk about some other investments, and that includes the provincial and Ottawa agreement that calls for childcare fees in Ottawa to be cut in half by the end of 2022, the creation of at least 9,500 spaces for childcare, and to bring childcare fees down to $10 a day on average by 2026. And then the conversation switches to tourism and small craft harbors.
Well, I mean, bottom line, it's this. It's the agreement will increase the quality and the affordability, the accessibility, and the flexibility and the inclusivity of early learning and child care program services for families in Nova Scotia. What I think is really particularly important, it's helping, families to make things more affordable, helping more women in particular to get back in the workforce while creating jobs and growing the middle class, Bill. And I think this is one spoke, I guess, or one pillar in addressing poverty in our area, is that affordable child care and the inability to have child care really has an impact on the entire family's ability to make the best possible life for their family. And so this $10 a day child care over the next couple of years is a real critical element to social development, personal development, economic development. It really is a huge, I think, game changer for many families in Cape Breton, CAMHSA, and right across the country. And to have that affordable daycare and to enable children to get the early childhood education they need, that's one thing. And the second thing is around enabling mothers and fathers to perhaps go back to school or perhaps being able to take on new job opportunities and things of that nature that are prohibited by so many people if you don't have childcare or you can't afford, more importantly, childcare. So a real big game changer for our province. And I was really pleased to see the announcement in Halifax, and I was on the announcement via Zoom. And I know there's thousands of stories of people that, can tell you stories about because of their inability to access childcare really became a disabler in terms of, jobs, economic development, putting food on the table, whatever the case may be. So I'm really pleased about this one, Bill, because it's one of the reasons one of the reasons I got into politics was to look at ways to combat, to fight against poverty in the area. And I think this is not the solution, but I think it is one of many solutions that need to be implemented. And I'm glad to see this one will, and very proud of everyone involved in this decision, in particular the early childhood educators and the different ways of the government who essentially work together to make this happen.
So, Mike, you've been for a long time telling communities that tourism operators need a lot of help, being one of the many sectors rocked because of COVID-19. What kind of help is being provided? And there is a recent announcement promising help for the operators in bouncing back. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, this is another important measure that was announced. So the federal government is going to fund an investment to support tourism-related businesses and organizations impacted by the pandemic. So it's called the Tourism Relief Fund, and it will be $500 million towards that fund. And we know tourism has been the sector, or one of the sectors, that have been hit pretty hard by COVID. And, we've had the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy and the Rent Subsidy and the Regional Relief and Recovery Fund. But there was more that needed to be done. And I met with a lot of tourism businesses throughout the riding, as did many other MPs in their riding. And what became clear is that we needed more investment to put into those hard-hit sectors, and the tourism sector is one of them. And one of those pillars of the economy in Cape Breton, CAMHSA, those small businesses. I used to be a small business owner, so I know what it's like. You do everything. You are the accountant. You are the manager. You are the person on the ground. You make sure everyone gets paid before you. And you are, by the way, you also clean and wash the bathroom. And so small businesses, it's overused, but it's overused because it's true, are the heartbeat of the economy of Canada. And Cape Breton, CAMHSA is no different. And tourism operators are a huge part of that heartbeat. So to be able to access money to support their businesses this year, through ACOA will be, I think, an important step in helping those businesses to just get through this summer. And, I know that it was a tough summer, beyond tough summer last year for the tourism sector. It will be a tough summer this year, but we are seeing some improvements in terms of occupancies, smaller, hostels and bed and breakfasts and other types of tourism-related locations. So, but we need more help, and this is really focused on that. And again, I met with so many, Bill, tourism operators throughout the riding, from Glace Bay to Inverness to Mabou to Cansown. They talked about the need for, you know, accessing funds to help their businesses. So there's going to be two kind of funds within that tourism relief fund bill. There's one that is non-repayable up to 75%, and that goes to about $100,000. And then there is a repayable loan without interest up to $500,000. So there's two options at play, but I encourage the tourism operators out there, small and large and medium, you know, to call me if they want more information, or reach out to your local ACOA branch, which for most of us is either ACOA in Sydney or ACOA in Port Hawkesbury, and reach out to those folks, and certainly reach out to my office. And again, keep working with people like Terry Smith at Destination Cape Breton, and working with folks throughout the riding. We, you know, we certainly have put our fingerprints on this particular investment. I'm really pleased to see that again.
So it's nothing new for the tourism industry to talk about the importance of a first impression and to help spread the word of their business. And hopefully they'll welcome people back for the following season or another season, and to encourage more stayovers. Is this more important now than ever because of COVID-19?
Most definitely, Bill. I think that your point around first impressions are exceptionally important ones. And, you know, I believe when you make sound investments in tourism in Cape Breton Council, they're going to pay off dividends beyond belief. And the reason why is we have hardworking men and women running those businesses and working within those businesses that care, that are passionate, that are authentic, that just have a drive to see, you know, their own community be better and provide that experience and leave that kind of lasting impression with somebody from Texas or somebody from Europe or wherever they may be coming from, and or the rest of Canada, or for that matter, people within Cape Breton or mainland Nova Scotia, to be able to provide that impact is really important. We want to see repeat business. We know that once people get a feel for Cape Bretoners and Cape Breton, they want to come back. And I think it's an opportunity to look at this fund to see how do we support businesses to not just stay afloat, Bill, but look at ways to how they can improve their business, and how do we look at extending our seasons as a collective with respect to the tourism sector, and how that benefits businesses, small, medium size, and large. I'm really bullish on tourism in Cape Breton and northeastern Nova Scotia. We have the natural beauty. We are making leaps and bounds in terms of infrastructure to support that natural beauty. But it is the people that run the businesses, the small business owner, and people that work for those businesses that leave that lasting impression. And when the federal government wants to, you know, it can do some amazing things. I look at the Canada Wage Subsidy. I've talked to so many businesses. So many, Bill, that I've lost count, quite frankly, on, you know, those businesses saying, if we didn't have the wage subsidy, we would probably not be here today. And that's just a testament to the resiliency and the ingenuity of average-day Canadians who put forth their ideas on how we could, you know, weather the storm of COVID, but also after COVID, what does this look like? And I think in Cape Breton, when it comes to the tourism sector, exceptionally bullish on where we go after COVID, and we're starting to come out of COVID. I see a lot of tourists around the local area. I have no doubt we're nowhere near where we were in 2019, but I believe we'll do better than we did in 2020. But the key thing, and it's for Cape Bretoners to believe, that we are a leading island when it comes to tourism, whether it's the services we provide and the people who provide those services. And with the right investment, we can, you know, be a multiplier effect, actually, in the tourism sector and impact other sectors as well. So very bullish on this money and the help that it will provide, but even more bullish on the tenacity and the resiliency and the vision of people in the tourism sector in Cape Breton. So, you know, I do my best to advocate every day for Cape Breton, northeastern Nova Scotia. As the elected chair, I've been advocating for the Tourism Relief Fund along with other MPs, and glad to see this come to fruition. But we know, you know, this is not a sprint, it's a race. So, you know, we'll monitor how this money is being used and how do we maximize it. But it's really the people of Cape Breton and northeastern Nova Scotia that I'm filled with gratitude for and happy for in terms of making the right moves forward with this money and building on it.
So Smallcraft Harbors is next on the list here. We can get to that in a moment if you would have a conversation about that. But first, you said you were a business owner too, Mike, and you probably know a thing or two about how busy it is. And, you know, all the clock does is remind you there aren't enough hours in the run of a day to get everything done. But with that recent childcare announcement, this seems to be a very good boost for the business owners who have kids. They would certainly find a lot of benefit in that.
Absolutely. I think it's a great observation, Bill. I mean, when you think of the people that work in the tourism sector, and if you have the inability to secure accessible childcare, affordable childcare, chances are you're going to stay home because you have no other option. And that takes you out of the employment opportunity that you may have or have. And so this, when I look at childcare, Bill, and for your listeners out there, and I look at a great example that you just used around tourism and the people that work in tourism, think of economic development and community development as a web. And it really is a web. And so one strand of web is childcare connected to another that is the tourism sector, that is connected to another in terms of post-secondary education and being able to access post-secondary education. We've heard nationwide through consultations that one of the greatest barriers to employment, to small business, to entrepreneurship is affordable childcare. And that would be no different in the tourism sector. And so if you're looking to enter the labor market, you have to have the ability, both in terms of accessibility and affordability, to put your child in the hands of people that care and to be able to pay for that and not break the bank. And it's an investment. It's an investment. Child care is an investment in, obviously, child health, child education. It's also around community wealth and families being able to generate incomes that contribute to other businesses, that contribute to spin-off businesses.
Got it. Okay. So Smallcraft Harbors, you made a recent announcement on the other side of the causeway with your riding stretching over to the mainland there, nearly $15 million. You talked about them being economic hubs. And what will this money do for the riding, Cape Breton Canso?
My riding is rather large. I would say my riding, geographically speaking, Bill, is probably in the top 20 geographic, you know, large ridings. It's not Northern Ontario, but it's not downtown Halifax either in terms of geographic size. So Smallcraft Harbors are located throughout our riding, you know, from Canso to Shettycamp to Glace Bay to Larry's River on the mainland to on the east side of the island, and Lordways, Mabou, Matadou, Petit de Gras. And these small craft harbors are what I call economic hubs. And some people might laugh at that and go, what do you mean, Mike? Well, we have a lot of fishers in our riding. The greatest export in Nova Scotia, by far, second place, and it's a distant second place, is Michelin Tires, is anything related to oceans. So lobster, crab, fish, other type of crustaceans. And it's exported throughout the world. We have men and women that are, in essence, small business owners. And then we have men and women who work for those small business owners just at the harbors alone. That contributes so much to the economic viability of the area that they reside in. Take Glace Bay, for example. So in Glace Bay, the multi-million-dollar investment, and I was really pleased to work with people like Herbie Nash and Bobby Trucker and others to dredge the channel and the basin, to pave around structures down there, and to provide other installation enhancements to the Glace Bay Harbor. Now, what is that going to do? It's going to create more efficiencies, more productivity. And it's also going to assist those businesses and those individuals that work in those businesses to do more. Now, people might say, well, that doesn't impact me. Don't be so sure of that. The men and women that work in the fishery are many. But equally important are the men and the women in Glace Bay and Madboo and Manadu and Port Morion that work with other businesses that are spin-off industries. So a more vibrant harbor, a more modern harbor, is going to impact the men and women directly and men and women indirectly. And by the way, it increases people's purchasing power in community. So, it impacts restaurants, it impacts other type of recreational services, it impacts the ability to, for people to have some disposable income. So these are really, really important. So, last year, I'm always, Bill, in our conversations, I've always been honest with you and the listeners, and I've been working on this particular file since probably April of last year to advocate for the riding because other MPs are doing the same. And I talked about how the small craft harbors, the fishery, is so, so important to my entire riding. And we've made, several presentations, pitches. We put forward plans in terms of what kind of investments could be made and why. We were close to $15 million last week making investments in the riding from Glace Bay, like I say, Manadu, Petit de Gras, Port Morion, Mabu, Machete Camp. And it took about a year to make happen. But it happened because we established relationships, not just with fishers, but fishers, first and foremost, but also local business people on how, investments in infrastructure will help fishers grow, develop, evolve their product lines and their ability to create greater efficiencies and the ability to house more fishers and so forth and so on. And it comes at a time when we may or may not have an election, I don't know. But I can say this, when it comes to this particular effort that we put forward, it's been a year in the making. Things like this don't happen overnight. And you're competing with other MPs across the country and their constituents for the same dollars. But working with the people of Cape Breton Canso, and this is where when you lived in the community and you worked in the community and you take time to get to know sectors that you had knowledge of but not extensive, and you learn and you take time to learn and listen to men and women in the sector, you learn, but also you incorporate them in your work in Ottawa. And this is pretty monumental. A lot of these small craft harbors haven't had substantial investment for quite some time. And when I traveled around the riding and got to see the infrastructure, I say this to the MPs in Montreal and Toronto and Vancouver, I say, you have your manufacturing center in downtown Vancouver, and that's your economic hub. One of the economic hubs we have in rural Nova Scotia, rural Cape Breton, northeastern Nova Scotia, is very much the harbor. And, when I look at places like Glace Bay, Bill, I can tell you that, I'm working with a broad cross-section of people and organizations and levels of government to look how we even build on this announcement that we just made in terms of the downtown harbor development, working with Develop Nova Scotia and the Glace Bay Harbor Authority and Cape Breton Partnership and the CBRM and the provincial government, and looking at how do we take this announcement and how do we multiply it in terms of developing Glace Bay Harbor, because I believe in my heart of hearts, I believe the opportunity to create an immense experience for not just the commercial side, but the recreational side in Glace Bay Harbor is real. And announcements like this can help be a springboard to what other things we're working on in the harbor.
Hey, Mike, we had a chance to talk to Herb Nash a few times, and you probably know you don't have to spend too much time wondering what's on Herb's mind. He will tell you. And he gets results because of his experience and being sincere in what he thinks is best for the fishing community. Would you like to see more Herb Nashes out there fighting for their communities?
Oh, absolutely. I look at the opportunities, for example, just as I mentioned, let's take Glace Bay Harbor. And we look at Glace Bay Harbor, and it's a commercial harbor, and a very successful one, and one that we're investing quite a bit of money in. People like Herbie in Glace Bay or Councillor Sampson in Richmond County, who's an amazing advocate for the fisheries and waterways, there are so many people, men and women, that are in the fishery that, yes, they are in the fishery, but their expertise, their knowledge can be translated into other opportunities that are related to the oceans that are not necessarily fishing. That could be tourism. That could be ecotourism. That could be looking at a whole new concept of downtown redevelopment in Glace Bay, utilizing the harbor as the springboard and building out. And I think those opportunities are real. And I think those opportunities are powered by the leadership of people like Herbie and Bobby, but also other people throughout the riding and their respective communities. The answers do not lie in Ottawa. You know, I often hear, well, you know, I've got 40 years of experience working in Ottawa, and that's great. But you have experience working in the community, working with Ottawa. That's a key, right? You have to have the pulse of the community. You have to have the pulse of the business community, the not-for-profit. You have to take time to listen to people. We're very humble people in Cape Breton, northeastern Nova Scotia. We don't sometimes like to think that we are got our expertise in community development, or we don't have the expertise in economic development. Innovation is a word that's in a textbook. It doesn't happen here. You better believe it happens here. And it's people like Herbie and Bobby, and there's people, you know, I think of somebody like in the political realm, like a Darren Bushwacker in Dominion, and the folks at the Hawks Field that I worked with. And those people are innovative. Those people have vision. And it's up to us. Economic development is up to us. It's not to a civil servant in Ottawa. It's not someone that has 40, 50 years and political experience. That's important. But it's us. It's always been us. And it needs to be us again. And I see those announcements as listening to people, listening to small business, listening to the moms and the dads out there, listening to people that have been disenfranchised from work for whatever reason, and listening. And then taking that and then working with people. Economic development's hard business. It's not an easy business. It takes, for real economic development to happen, you really need to engage and work with people. But know that you're in it for the right reasons. And the people, and all these announcements that we've been making, that I've been making, are the result of people in my community working with me and me with them at looking at how do we do better? How do we enable a better place for not just our kids, but for our own families now? And those are just some of the many things that I've seen. But that's the common DNA in all these announcements, you know? And I couldn't be more happier and proud of the people, you know, in this riding, because they are innovative, they are caring, they are resilient, they are hardworking. There's no self-defeatist attitude here. They're in the game. They're in the arena. They're taking their swings. Sometimes you hit the ball, sometimes you don't, but we keep swinging.
Okay, so I think on that note, Mike, we'll let you go. You're always very generous with your time. Thanks for sharing the information about those recent announcements. And if we don't catch up soon, have a great summer, and we'll talk again.
Thank you so much. You always have the time. And I mean, so many people listen to The Coast, my mom included. So I just appreciate the time to be on the air to talk to people and talk to you.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of The Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.